To hear previous Making Waves shows, please visit our archive online at www.freewebs.com/sprav/audio.htm. Please email us at nhmakingwaves@yahoo.com and let us know what you think of our show or that you'd like to volunteer with us. Also, feel free to call the station in the next hour for more info. That number is 430-9722. Next up is Tom Jackson interviewing Tom Lee, a New Hampshire author who recently published a book called Battle Babble, Selling War in America. The book exposes the rhetoric of war through a series of expanded definitions. Here we go to Tom and Tom.
Talking with New Hampshire author Thomas Lee. His brand new book, Battle Babble, Selling War in America, has just been released.
In the years literally leading up to the current war in Iraq, being retired, I thought I really ought to watch a little more television. That was one of the things retired people should do. So I began to watch cable TV, and it became very obvious that this particular war, not unlike other wars, was being sold before it happened as entertainment, particularly in the cable channels, MSNBC, Fox, obviously, even CNN. They were vying for each other for graphics, talking heads, retired generals, and so on. So there was an air of unreality about the war. War was entertainment. The language that was used by these mainstream media was the same language being used by government spokespersons. This was language to really in two categories: language that softens the harsh realities of war, killing, mutilation, torture, destruction of people's lives, and language which encouraged participation and support for the war under the guise of patriotism. It was so obvious to me after only a short time of following this that by the time the war began, I began thinking of writing something which zeroed in on this particular aspect of war propaganda, that is the language used to encourage participation and to essentially soften reality.
Can you give some examples of some of the terms that you describe in Battle Babble?
Sure. The book really has three categories, although they're not designated as such. I've really set this up as a dictionary. It's in alphabetical form. There are over 200 terms that I included. There are really three categories. One is familiar euphemisms, things that we're used to hearing: collateral damage, friendly fire, detainees, and the whole set of typical euphemisms for killing: neutralize, dispatch, take out, mopping up, cleaning up. And those are euphemisms that we're used to, although they've become part of the background of war. I also included a category of terms which aren't ordinarily thought of as euphemisms, terms that sound rather comforting: Committee for the Liberation of Iraq, National Security Strategy, Committee for the Protection and Security of the Gulf, this sort of thing. And I've also included what I found was important is a whole series of words which we've come to accept and be comfortable with surrounding war. Words like glory, bravery, terms like win the peace, God bless our country, God bless our troops, support the troops, patriotism. If you analyze these, all of these are part of the language surrounding war to engender support and to cover the reality of war. So these are the categories. I'll give you a few examples. Let me add first that I began to write this book in what I thought would be a series of 400 or 500 brief definitions of war euphemisms. It turned out that as I started writing the definitions, they turned into short essays because one can't really give a snap definition. I didn't want the book to be simply satire. There's a whole category of books out there, Bush bashing books, many of which I've read and I've enjoyed. But I wanted this to be a book which was, first of all, honest, give facts, give the truth. And I want it to be ironic. Irony in its strict sense means using one's own words to prove the issue. And what I've done is quote people and use the terms that are actually used in the media and by the government and let them speak for themselves in many cases. Let me just give you a couple of sample parts of definitions. Most of these run a page or so or more. My definition of win the peace. After attacking the enemy, devastating their land, and killing and injuring sufficient numbers of them to cause them to surrender, convince them that all the terrible destruction, death, and suffering was for their ultimate benefit. If any object to this largesse and become aggressive, they are to be terrified into submission, or if necessary, killed. Eventually, all survivors are expected to be content with their lot. If you look at patriotism, I begin this way. Patriotism, generally understood as a devoted loyalty to and support for one's country. This notion is particularly dangerous when one identifies one's country, as the prevailing government. In that case, the ideal patriot abets in and obeys the orders of the state, including its injunctions to wage war. Those who rebel against the decisions of the state are considered unpatriotic. Perhaps I could read on page 193... the injunction which our president has often used, God bless, an invocation popular in the United States, especially among its elected leaders, asking the divinity, generally regarded as Christian, to look favorably on the United States and its troops as they fight the enemy, who are not to be considered worthy of God's protection. And if I may add one more, because this was the first definition I wrote, when I was first trying to decide how I would actually write this book. I woke up one morning about 4 o'clock and this definition appeared to me, as it does when you're writing things. Writing is really dictation. It somehow appears after a lot of thought. But let me just read quickly my complete definition of flag. Flag, a piece of cloth variously colored, often displayed in order to stimulate feelings of patriotism among citizens. The American flag bears 13 stripes of white and red, representing the 13 colonies established on land taken by force from the original inhabitants. The flag represents honor, hope, and pride, often justifiably. Those citizens who display the flag, on their vehicles or elsewhere, are regarded by many to be the more loyal to their country. Military personnel are taught to have a particular devotion to the flag. When they are killed in the line of duty, their coffins are draped with the flag. It is removed before interment because burying a flag is considered to be disrespectful.
It seems to me, especially when we're talking about I realize some of these terms go back, you know, way, way far back, but with some of the ones that are currently in use, particularly for application to so-called Iraqi freedom, these are not terms that George W. Bush comes up with. It seems to me he's too linguistically challenged to be the one coming up with these things. Where do these things come from? Have you gotten a sense of that in your research?
Many of the terms that appear in this book are terms that have been around for many, many years. Honor, bravery, and so on. There's a whole new set, particularly when it has to do, as you mentioned, Operation Iraqi Freedom. The practice of naming military functions as operations goes back to before the Second World War. In fact, Winston Churchill was quite instrumental in developing this system. Churchill, I must add, I'm getting off track here, but it's to the point. We ought to remember, and there's a lot of history in this book, a lot of facts and history about all of this. We should remember that the British occupied Iraq back in around 1920, and essentially occupied that country for over the next 30 years under various guises. Churchill, in the early years of by the British occupation of Iraq, ordered carpet bombing. In fact, was one of the co-inventors of the carpet bombing tactic. That is, you bomb everything, everything in sight. In fact, Churchill wanted to use poison gas to suppress these nasty Iraqis who were making trouble. But they wouldn't allow him to do that, but he certainly did lay waste to the country. So this is, to Iraq, this is not new. The British have come back. But at any rate, under operation, a quote from Winston Churchill. Churchill, early to understand the public relation value of labels, warned against names for military functions that disparage in any way or enable some widow or mother to say that her son was killed in an operation called Bunny Hug or Ballyhoo. So by the war's end, the War Department, which is now the Department of Defense, began creating names for all sorts of things. Operation Crossroads was one of the first for the atomic bomb tests and Bikini. And, of course, this went right up into Vietnam, Operation Masher, Operation Killer. But we've now, the Department of Defense now says that operations must be selected carefully so as not to be, quote, counterproductive, or, quote, to express a degree of bellicosity inconsistent with traditional American ideals or current foreign policy. You might remember that the invasion of Afghanistan. In this book, I emphasize the Gulf War, the first Gulf, first war against Iraq, and the second war, Operation Iraqi Freedom, as it's called, and also Operation Enduring Freedom, which was our assault against Afghanistan. You might remember that the original name was Operation Infinite Justice, but there was an outcry of that against that because obviously that is. It became obvious it was offensive to the Islamic world, which, of course, by the way, our entire operations against Iraq are, and this is what's created terrorism. There were no terrorists in Iraq before our latest attack, and there certainly are now. We've spawned this.
It seems to me that language has become more of something that's inspired or even directly drawn from marketing-type firms and PR firms and things like that. I mean, groups like Hill & Knowlton and the Rendon Group have been used extensively for the last 10 or 15 years by our government to pitch things. And then, of course, you have Condoleezza Rice a couple of years ago when talking about the impending invasion of Iraq, saying something to the effect that it didn't happen in August because you never roll out a new product in August or something to that effect. I mean, do you have a sense that a lot of these terms are sort of pitched by that type of firm?
You're absolutely right on the use of public relations firms to push the war. I think that George Bush, as I think many people acknowledge, does not generate a lot of his own ideas. He has a lot of people surrounding him. And certainly Hill & Knowlton and the Rendon Group were given literally millions of dollars in the lead-up to the war. And I have a number of references to this in the book. Public relations campaigns to essentially sell the war. The war was sold under false pretenses. The war, of course, was sold as a means of preventing Iraq from attacking us with weapons of mass destruction. When that did not prove to be the case, which certainly the Pentagon knew beforehand, it somehow morphed into an effort to liberate Iraq and somehow democratize. These terms are all in democratization. I must add here that my position, I didn't simply write this book out of an exercise, or I'm not an English professor, an exercise in rhetoric. My basic position is that this war should never have been fought, and further, no wars should ever be fought. My position is that of a pacifist, I think we should be using at least as much energy and funding towards developing nonviolent solutions to international conflicts as we do for the military. And that's a tall order. As soon as you say pacifist, that's kind of an inflammatory term. It's a tall order, but I want my book to be a part of that effort to move towards, and I mentioned this in my preface, to move towards nonviolent means of resolving conflict. And the way I decided to do that, to play my part in that, is to expose the language surrounding war and the language supporting war as what I hope will be a means to move people, the general public, towards an understanding of the realities of war and the need to develop nonviolent means. That's what's really was behind my writing this. When people write what are called liberal or progressive books, they often end up preaching to the choir. And I know a lot of the choir, and I love them, and I hope they read the book. But I also want the book to get into the mainstream. Fortunately, the book has been recommended by several people who are very much involved in peace education across the country, high school and college courses and programs. And I'm hoping that it will be used as a reference source for students studying peace and justice. It's filled with website references and other references that they can use as a good source to go on and follow up on a lot of these ideas. I'd like to add as well that this book is not an anti-soldier book. This is an anti-war book. I make it very clear that the young men who are asked to join the military and who are offered the propaganda of money, learning a profession, adventure, travel. I don't blame these young men. Once they're in, once they're taught to kill whoever the government tells them is the enemy, then they're not given a chance to express any moral scruples. If they do, this is considered out of line, and they face jail. So many young men, I certainly know from a lot of reading and study and talking to people on this, so many of the young men and women in Iraq don't want to be there, don't think they should be there, but they're impressed with their commitment to their requirements. And, of course, there's always the overlay of the sense of patriotism and so on, which is confused and which I can talk about in this book. So what I want to make very clear is that I'm not criticizing soldiers or individuals. I think we're all subject to this wave of rhetoric, which is very harmful, and I don't blame them at all.
When we were talking about the current Bush administration and their use of PR firms and so on that influence the language that ultimately is used to push a violent agenda or a warlike agenda, I think it's worth pointing out that this is not something that's exclusive to the Republican Party or any other party. It seems to me that I recall something about humanitarian bombings back during the Clinton administration.
Yeah, one of the definitions of my book is humanitarian intervention. Humanitarian intervention means going into a country and bombing the hell out of it for their own good. I might add that after the Gulf War, 1991, Iraq was subjected to 12 years of sanctions, which included not only the starvation of probably a million Iraqis, but constant bombing, including bombing ordered by the Clinton administration. So this country was devastated for many, many years before we went back and laid waste to it again.
And it was interesting and also tragic that, going with the point you just made, during the run-up, and the drum beating for war and going into Iraq, the Bush administration never mentioned those bombings in the so-called no-fly zones. They never mentioned that there was somewhere between 300,000 and 400,000 sorties flown by U.S. and British warplanes, and that during those years, not one single manned aircraft was ever shot down by the Iraqis, and that in fact was more of a measure of Iraqi military capability than the so-called supposed WMDs.
Yeah, the Iraqi Operation Iraqi Freedom, as it's called, is widely touted as a brilliant military victory. The Iraqis had no air force. They had old weapons. It was a slaughter in the same way that back in 1991, when the Iraqis were fleeing Kuwait, trying to get home, the infamous Turkey shoot, which I discussed in the book as well, which was they were strafed up and down the highway. They were defenseless. I should add another point, which I wanted to mention, and that is one of the reasons that the government has to persuade us that this war this more recent war was justified is that there really are only two reasons for us being in Iraq. The first reason is to establish a permanent military presence in the Middle East. And the second is to have access to the oil in Iraq. As I point out in the book, and many others have pointed out, Sudan has nothing of interest or value to us. If it had oil, we would be there in force, stopping the genocide and probably contributing to some of it as well. So that those are the two reasons we're in Iraq. All of the other subterfuges, freedom, democracy, liberation, and so on, are simply false, and they need a masquerade of rhetoric to cover the real reasons.
Does the book itself, or you as an author, have a website, or where could people get more information about the book?
I don't have a website. I know what would happen if I did, and I don't want to be inundated. But the book is certainly available. It's early now. It just came out, but it's available through its publisher, Common Courage Press, in Maine. Locally, in Portsmouth, the book is going to be available at the River Run Bookstore. I support independent bookstores, so I won't mention the other places it can be obtained. But River Run certainly here, over in Concord at Gibson's, I hope to make it widely available.
Well, we hope so too. And Thomas Lee, author of Battle Babble, New Hampshire author, I might add. Thanks a lot for being with us today.
You're very welcome. I appreciate the opportunity.
And now for Between the Lines, independent radio out of Bridgeport, Connecticut.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Neve Gordon of Ben-Gurion University, who considers the effect of Israel's withdrawal of settlements from occupied Gaza on the long-stalled peace process. Kim Gandy, president of the National Organization for Women, who assesses the known record of John Roberts, President Bush's nominee to the U.S. Supreme Court. And Barbara Fair, an organizer with People Against Injustice, who discusses the goals of a recent rally in Washington, D.C., calling attention to inequities within the nation's prison industrial complex. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In the disputed region of Western Sahara, the mid-August release of the last 404 Moroccan prisoners of war captured by the pro-independence Polisario Front could spark a new peace initiative in the area which Morocco invaded in 1975. In fighting during the late 1970s and 80s, the Polisario Front captured 2,400 prisoners who were gradually released to the International Red Cross in the years since the 1991 ceasefire. Over the last 14 years, Morocco has refused to allow a vote on self-determination for Western Sahara. For months, tens of thousands of Moroccans have marched for the release of all prisoners held by the rebel Polisario Front. According to the BBC, these prisoners were the longest held in any conflict in the world. The Front has called on the Moroccan government to release 150 prisoners of war and to account for 500 people who disappeared in the 35-year conflict. American Congressman Joe Pitts, a Pennsylvania Republican, observed, "The Sahrawis, just like everybody else, have a right to self-determination. That right was robbed by colonial powers, first Spain and now Morocco. All they want to do is vote." New documents in human rights lawsuits against Chevron link the oil giant to violence by the Nigerian military on January 4, 1999. At that time, villagers went to a Chevron facility in Opia to demand payment for environmental damage. A few hours later, the Nigerian army sent troops in helicopters who shot unarmed civilians and burnt down villages. Earthright International, or ERI, is a public interest law firm that has filed two cases against Chevron in American courts. The cases, based on the Alien Tort Claims Act, are seeking relief for human rights abuses such as extrajudicial killing. A separate case in state court in California charges the oil giant with violating the state's professional standards code and engaging in misleading and fraudulent business practices. The new documents, which emerged in court proceedings, consist of an invoice and a receipt of payment by Chevron to 22 Nigerian soldiers a day after the incident. The invoice is signed by the army captain, who witnesses blame in court papers for leading the attack on Opia. Chevron, which is buying out Unical and settled another human rights case in Burma earlier this year, denied any linkage between the payments and the attack. As Rick Hares, an ERI lawyer in the case, told socialfunds.com, a website for socially responsible investors, when your employees commit murder and show up the next day to get paid, you are ratifying their action. The manatee, an endangered sea animal, is at the center of a bitter dispute between an international coalition of environmentalists and the U.S. Marine Corps on the Japanese island of Okinawa. Now, the U.S. Marines want a sea-based heliport which would be built on top of a coral reef with a runway extending up to a mile into the Pacific Ocean. Eco-activists say 50 genetically different species would be endangered by the plan. On behalf of groups in Japan and the United States, the Arizona-based Center for Biological Diversity has filed a lawsuit in U.S. federal court against the Pentagon to stop the heliport. According to E, the environmental magazine, the beach near the proposed marine base is home to three species of endangered sea turtles, the green, hawkbill, and loggerhead. In its defense, the Pentagon says the heliport is really a project of the Japanese government and outside U.S. jurisdiction. However, that argument does not convince environmentalists. The Center for Biological Diversity has unearthed documents that the U.S. Marine Corps is granting the Japanese permission to conduct land surveys of the site. On Okinawa, opposition to the military heliport remained strong. In the late 1990s, island residents voted overwhelmingly to reject the project in a non-binding plebiscite, owing to nearby residents' concern about aircraft noise and fear of accidents. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Indu Anand.
The evacuation of some 9,000 settlers and their supporters from Israeli-occupied Gaza and four smaller settlements in the West Bank was completed without much of the violent resistance and national discord initially feared. Now that the settlers have been forced out, the Israeli army will be demolishing houses and other infrastructure left behind. The Palestinian Authority, not yet certain about the extent of their new power after the Israeli withdrawal, are making plans to build apartments for Gaza's desperately poor population on the land once occupied by Jewish settlers. The unilateral decision by Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon to close the Gaza settlements was accompanied by a parallel plan to continue expanding Israel's 120 settlements in the occupied West Bank. The current population of more than 220,000 settlers in the West Bank, not including those living in East Jerusalem, has been expanding at the rate of 10,000 a year. Israelis and Palestinians advocating a resumption of peace talks believe Sharon's policy of expanding West Bank settlements is a key obstacle standing in the way of negotiating a lasting peace agreement. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Neve Gordon, who teaches political science at Israel's Ben-Gurion University. He considers the effect of Sharon's withdrawal of settlements from occupied Gaza on the long-stalled Israeli-Palestinian peace negotiations.
I think the settlers in the past month have tried to take the personal trauma that some of the residents actually felt, because they've been living there, after all, for over 20 years and even more, and try to transform this personal trauma into a national trauma in order to basically try to prevent any further withdrawal from the West Bank. And I think it was a well-orchestrated attempt. In some ways it worked, and in other ways it failed. But ultimately, what came across, that settlements can be dismantled and the Jewish settlers can be brought back to Israel proper.
Neve, while Israeli troops withdrew the settlers from the Gaza area, at the same time, Israel is expanding its major settlements in the West Bank. Discuss that for us, if you would.
Sharon realized a while back that the Gaza Strip is a military liability. In terms of demography, there were 8,000 settlers and well over a million Palestinians. The settlers controlled one-third or even more of the land, but basically there was no chance that in the future Israel could in any way really gain strong hold on the Gaza Strip. In the West Bank, the situation is very different. In the West Bank, there's probably close to 220,000 settlers in around 115 settlements. That's excluding East Jerusalem, where there's close to another 200,000 settlers. So what Sharon decided to do is really give Gaza back, return Gaza, in order to deepen the annexation of the West Bank. In the government agreement, when Israel decided to withdraw from the Gaza Strip, it is said, and I quote, that areas within the West Bank will remain part of the state of Israel, among them civilian settlements, military zone, and places where Israel has additional interest. Now, the Bush administration has supported this clause. Sharon visited the United States a few weeks back, and in one of the meetings with Jewish donors during that meeting, he said something very important. He said, and again, I quote from the Israeli paper Haaretz, "There won't be negotiations with the Palestinians about Jerusalem or the settlement blocks of Ariel, Maale Edomim, and Gush Etzion." And then he added, "They will remain eternally under Israeli sovereignty within a contiguous territory." Now, the listeners should keep in mind, what is this Ariel, Maale Edomim, and Gush Etzion? These are actually three of the major settlement blocks that if you may keep them under contiguous territory, you're basically controlling the whole West Bank or large parts of it. So I think we should understand the Gaza withdrawal as an attempt to consolidate Israel's power over large parts of the West Bank. And Sharon will agree to some kind of withdrawal from maybe around 50% of the West Bank. Of course, that will never be a viable Palestinian state, and the Palestinians will not agree to that. And then we return to the cycle of violence.
Ariel Sharon's decision to withdraw from Gaza was a unilateral decision. It did not involve negotiations with the Palestinian Authority, and there was no quid pro quo. It was just based on Sharon's view of what was best for Israel. What can you tell us about how the Gaza withdrawal will affect the prospects for restarting negotiations between the Palestinians and the Israelis?
What I think will happen, even if they restart, is that they'll very soon reach an impasse. I'm not sure they'll restart also because of internal Israeli politics. It seems that Israel might go to an election fairly soon, and if it does, no one will want to negotiate with Palestinians in the meantime. But even if they do start, I think they'll reach an impasse because Sharon or his contender in the Likud, Netanyahu, are unwilling to negotiate and are unwilling to compromise on the three basic issues that have to be compromised about in order to reach a solution. And these three issues are a full withdrawal to the 1967 borders, a withdrawal from East Jerusalem, and some kind of creative solution for the Palestinian refugees. Now, Sharon has said and Netanyahu have said several times they're unwilling to withdraw to the 1967 borders. They're unwilling to make any compromise on Jerusalem, and they are unwilling to even to discuss the refugee problem. And so far as that is the case, we're looking ahead is into the resumption of violence. And I think that the violence that will take place after withdrawal will be much more lethal than it was until now. I think now that Israel has withdrawn from the Gaza Strip, we should expect to see the kind of violence Israel used in Lebanon, and that is much more frequent attacks using Apache helicopters, F-16 planes, and so forth. And, of course, I expect also the Palestinians to react. I expect them to start shooting missiles to Israel. And as we know, this is a never-ending story.
That was Neve Gordon of Ben-Gurion University. His article, Will Withdrawal Make Gaza a Frontier Ghetto?, published in the August 18th edition of In These Times magazine, can be read online at www.inthesetimes.com. As the U.S. Senate prepares to conduct confirmation hearings this September on John Roberts, President Bush's nominee to the Supreme Court, thousands of documents have been released from Roberts' tenure as an attorney working in President Reagan's White House counsel's office from 1982 to 1986. But the Bush administration continues to block the release of more recent documents from the period when Roberts served as Deputy Solicitor General from 1989 to 1993 under the president's father. Among the papers released by the government and the Reagan Library was an internal memo that showed Roberts had less than a supportive view of efforts to combat discrimination against women. In 1985, he asked whether encouraging homemakers to become lawyers contributes to the common good. In another memo, Roberts labeled measures to require employers to provide men and women with equal pay for equal work staggeringly pernicious and anti-capitalist. Along with Roberts' unsettling views on women's rights, there is growing concern among pro-choice groups on the nominee's hostility toward the right to privacy and reproductive rights. Between the Lines' Scott Harris spoke with Kim Gandy, president of the National Organization for Women, who assesses the known record of John Roberts, who, if confirmed by the Senate, would replace retiring moderate Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor.
We've taken a formal position opposing his confirmation based not only on his stated positions and commentaries on women's rights, but on a broad range of individual rights and civil rights issues. First, he has in his 1981 to 85 papers as a White House advisor, comes across very clearly as someone who opposes at a fairly deep level the issue of women's equality. He, in those writings, refers to the idea of pay equity for women as anti-capitalist and staggeringly pernicious, implying that there really wasn't any discrimination against women. He referred to, quote, perceived problems of gender discrimination. Like, they're not real, they're just perceived problems, and referred to the purported gender gap and the like. And I think one of the things most recently reported was in discussing whether a White House staffer could be nominated for an award that recognized women who had changed their lives and made a contribution to society. He all but smirked, well, some might question whether encouraging homemakers to become lawyers contributes to the common good, which was, might sound like a joke now, but it was a fairly common opinion among young male lawyers at that time. But beyond that, in legal determinations, he has worked against the Voting Rights Act, against the Americans with Disabilities Act, against affirmative action, against Title IX, Equal Educational Opportunity for Women and Girls, against interpretations of Title VII and even the Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution that would give equal rights, even equal employment rights, to women, very, very broadly construing the right of the judiciary to undo acts of Congress while at the same time pretending to be someone who wants to narrow the scope of what judges can do and increase the scope of what belongs properly to politicians, as in essentially saying that Roe should be overturned because these kinds of social decisions should be in the hands of politicians. Yet when politicians do take action, as with the Americans with Disabilities Act, for example, or Title IX, Equal Employment Opportunities for Girls and Women, he wants to, as a judge, narrow them. So he takes a circular approach depending on which one fits with his ideology.
Kim, I wanted to ask you about reproductive rights and the right to privacy. Because Judge Roberts has been a federal judge for so short a time, there isn't a really heavy track record there on his own views on that important topic. But what can you tell us about Judge Roberts and what we know on his views of reproductive rights?
Well, actually, we've had about the best opportunity that we're going to get to see his views, unless they release the papers from his time as a Solicitor General and give us some more insight into that. His time as a judge wouldn't be likely to tell us too much anyway, because as a lower court judge, he is indeed bound by the precedents like Roe v. Wade. So in fact, his writings as an advisor to the president in determining whether or not, for example, the administration ought to get involved in a case involving Roe, or as he was in the Solicitor General's office actually making those decisions as the top political deputy, he chose on at least two occasions to personally get involved in cases that directly affected Roe v. Wade, and to argue himself that Roe v. Wade was wrongly decided and should be overturned, very specifically. We're already looking at 5-4 on women's basic rights to choose abortion. So if O'Connor is replaced by John Roberts, if John Roberts rules the same way as those other four justices, then we've got a serious problem. That is effectively a reversal of Roe. Even if they don't say the words Roe is reversed, it becomes an effective reversal, a de facto reversal of Roe.
During an earlier fight over nominees to the federal bench, 7 Democrats and 7 Republicans in the Senate made an agreement to not use the filibuster against any of the president's future nominees unless it fit the category of an extraordinary circumstance. Do you feel that Judge Roberts' nomination to the Supreme Court is such an extraordinary event that the filibuster should be used?
Oh, I absolutely do. I think it's clear that in the case of any nominee who is essentially presented as a blank slate, but only because the White House refuses to reveal the documents that would tell you otherwise, leaving you nothing more to judge him on except his writings from the early 80s, which the White House says, oh, but you can't judge him on that, that was so long ago. How could any senator, Republican or Democratic, in good conscience, cast a vote for a nominee under those circumstances, under such a shroud of secrecy?
That was Kim Gandy, president of the National Organization for Women. Call now at area code 202-628-8669 or visit their website at www.now.org. On August 13th, people opposed to what they call the prison industrial complex rallied in Washington, D.C. under the banner, 2 million incarcerated is too many. That's a reference to the more than 2 million prison inmates in the U.S. who are overwhelmingly poor and mostly people of color. A large percentage of the U.S. prison population are serving time for nonviolent, mostly drug-related crimes. The rally in the nation's capital was the brainchild of Roberta Franklin, an ex-felon who works with an Alabama prison reform group, family members, and friends of people incarcerated. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Barbara Fair, an organizer with People Against Injustice in New Haven, Connecticut, one of several local groups in the state that have been fighting discrimination in the prison industrial complex. Three of her sons have been caught up in the criminal justice system, and she says she's fighting to make sure her grandchildren don't suffer the same fate. Fair, who helped organize the Washington rally, recounts some of the issues highlighted there, as well as future directions for the prison reform movement.
They talked about doing away with mandatory minimum sentences, the three strikes law, the disparities and the crack cocaine law on the federal level, and just a lot of things that truly cause the mass industry that we have in this country right now. With the mandatory minimum sentences, there are quite a few judges who have come out in opposition of this policy because they say it takes out of their hands the control of the sentences that they pass on to people. They feel that because of the policy says, okay, if you have a drug sentence, you must serve at least 13 years, say, I'm just using that number. The judge may feel this is too harsh for this person. They consider the circumstances of their life and all that. But because mandatory minimums are in effect, they can't consider any of those things. They have to sentence this person that. The crack versus cocaine policy, there's a great disparity in who's sitting in prison because of that. And that's because people who would use possession or sales of crack would get a much harsher sentence than those people in possession of powder cocaine. The disparity comes in because the people using crack, because it's a cheaper drug, are usually found in the urban areas of America as opposed to suburban areas where you find the powder cocaine, which is the more expensive form of cocaine. So, of course, you're filling up the prison system with more poorer people in the country.
Connecticut's population is about 20% black and Latino, yet the state's prison population is at least 75% black and Latino. And you actually worked with other people this past year to change the crack cocaine disparity law.
Yes, we did. We worked with several groups just trying to bring attention to our governor about the disparity, the racial disparity in the prison system here and how much of it is because of the crack versus cocaine policy. Originally, Governor Rell vetoed the bill because she felt it was being soft on crime, but then we kept it up and we just continued to give her information. It's not about being soft on crime. It's about justice. It's about, you know, fairness in the system.
So what was the final outcome of the bill?
To equalize the sentences at 14 grams. So whether a person has crack cocaine or powder cocaine, 14 grams gives you a mandatory minimum sentence, and I think that mandatory minimum is 3 years, but I'm not definite.
And we should point out that 14 grams is half an ounce.
Yes. Now, that was like a beginning of the struggle for us, because what we really would like to do is end the drug war, period, which is another thing that was going on in Washington, just end the drug war, because we find that this drug war has been a dismal failure for over three decades now, and all it did is fill the prison up with nonviolent drug offenders. We'd rather see those people get treatment and jobs as opposed to, you know, locking them away in prison for years.
And isn't it true that as the prison population has increased, educational and social programs have been cut?
Yes. Years ago, prisons were for the violent offenders, and they offered rehabilitation programs, education, anything that would help that person come back to society as a law-abiding member. Now what we have over the last, like I said, couple of decades is we see this rise in prison industry where it's no longer about rehabilitation. They're just warehousing people. We have men and women who actually spend 22 hours in a cell a day. And the sad part about all of this is that all of these people eventually, majority I must say, are going to come back to the streets. What do you expect to get from that person when you warehouse them in a cell for 22 hours a day and then you release them into society with no kind of program and no kind of treatment, no kind of assistance with housing, medicine, jobs, nothing? You know, and then you end up coming right back into the system. And that's what we want to stop. We want to stop that. First of all, sending these people in prison that don't belong, that are mentally ill, the substance abuse people. We don't even want those people to go in prison in the first place. But if they're there, we'd like to see things that are going to help them, not make them worse.
Earlier this month, people celebrated the 40th anniversary of the Voting Rights Act. I know you and others around the country have highlighted the denial of voting rights to ex-felons, and that's a growing part of the population.
Well, we did have some success in Connecticut because now people in Connecticut can vote once they leave prison, unless they're on parole. They have to finish their parole. We would like to see that as long as people are out here working and paying taxes, that they should have the right to vote. And we'd like to see that continue all over the country. Because that march in Washington was primarily about one thing. It was about all of us from around this country, different states, going back to our community and bringing forth what we learned in Washington about the various states, to bring that back to your community and continue. Let that be a starting point for us to come back to our states and work harder and change in the policies.
That was Barbara Fair of People Against Injustice in Connecticut. For more information on national prison reform efforts, call rally organizer Roberta Franklin at area code 334-220-4670. Or visit her group's website at www.journeyforjustice.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly program summaries and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written and performed by Mika Tak. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Indu Anand, Bill Cosentino, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.
Thanks for joining us on Making Waves, Independent Voices for Peace and Justice. The Making Waves crew is Amy Antonucci, Steve Diamond, Tom Jackson, Stanley Longstaff, Adam Meyerowitz, Joanne Paradise, Damon Thomas, and Jeff White. We welcome your participation too. You can live stream our show on Saturdays from 2 to 4 if you're not in range of the station, by going to www.wirenh.com. Tune in next Saturday from 2 to 4 for our next Making Waves program. Our theme will be Back to School, with interviews of Mike Vivas, a retired public school teacher, on the assault on education, and Durham, New Hampshire public school teachers Melinda Salazar and Kay Morgan talk to us about teaching peace in local public schools. We'll also give you some information about military recruiting in school systems. We leave you now with this quote from the Nuremberg War Crime Tribunal of 1950. Individuals have international duties which transcend the national obligations of obedience. Therefore, individual citizens have the duty to violate domestic laws to prevent crimes against peace and humanity from occurring.